The recipients of this year's World Food Prize, announced this week, were honored for independently developing the science of modern plant biotechnology. This hour, we'll hear from one of the new laureates, Robert Fraley. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We'll also talk with Ken Quinn, former U.S. Ambassador and President of the World Food Prize Foundation, about the significance of this year's prize. Then, capitalism. Does it work for you? That's the question on a 20-foot-long sign with flashing lights that's come to Cedar Rapids. Viewers vote by pressing true or false. We'll talk with the artist behind the project, Steve Lambert. New World Food Prize laureate Rob Fraley, after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This week, three distinguished scientists were named the winners of the 2013 World Food Prize. Mark Van Montague of Belgium, along with Mary Dell Chilton, and Robert Fraley of the United States. The prize is sometimes called the Nobel Prize for Food and Agriculture. Now, the recipients of this year's World Food Prize were honored for independently developing the science of modern plant biotechnology. Their work has opened doors to improve crops that can feed the world more effectively and sustainably. Joining me now, one of those 2013 World Food Prize recipients, Robert Fraley, on the phone. Robert Fraley, welcome to the program.
Well, great to be on.
Now, you are a pioneer in genetically modified crops. You have spent your entire career at Monsanto. I understand you are now the company's chief technology officer.
Oh, that's right.
Okay. Start off by describing collectively, you're honored with two others here, if you could describe collectively the advances the three of you have made in biotechnology, why you're grouped together.
So going back to the late 70s and early 80s, Mary Dell Chilton, who I know well, who used to be at Washington University in St. Louis, and Mark Van Montague and his colleague Jeff Schell in Europe, and our laboratory were three of the key laboratories around the world who were working in this area of the application of biotechnology and agriculture. And so while we were competing to be the first to be able to achieve this result, we were colleagues and we knew each other well from lots of meetings and lots of conversations around the science. So in many ways, it's really special to have both Mark and Mary Dell recognized along with me, and it's going to be a lot of fun when we get together for that week in Des Moines to share some old stories.
Okay. Tell us more about your work specifically. What do you point to in your long career as key accomplishments?
Well, I think the key for our team here, and it was, as always, a team of folks. When I joined Monsanto, I think there were three or four people working in the biotech space. Back then, Monsanto was mostly working in the industrial chemical area, and particularly the three of us, myself, Steve Rogers, Rob Horsch, worked together, and we developed and demonstrated for the first time the ability to put a new gene into a plant cell. And back then, those were, petunia cells, and we were able to show that we could get the gene is in, that the genes would work, that the plant cells could be regenerated into whole plants, and those plants would flower and pass those genes on to the next generation through seed. And that was really the first demonstration that this whole area of biotechnology could be applied in agriculture. And then from there on out, we worked hard to apply it to the commercial crops, the corn, the soybeans, the cotton, the sugar beets. And, we were the first to launch biotech crops. And in 1996, crops like Roundup Ready soybeans, YieldGuard corn, BoguGuard cotton were introduced into the marketplace.
Mm-hmm. So explain a little bit more in layman's terms, of course, how you genetically engineer a crop, how you insert a gene. What is the process? Sort of a brief how-to summary, if you could.
Sure, and the key to this, as you've gone through, I'm sure the different commentaries from Mary Dell and Mark, as well as ours, is the unique bacterium called Agrobacterium. And both Mark and Mary Dell had studied a lot of the biology of this bug, and we used a lot of their information that had been in the literature and at meetings. And we're able to take advantage of this bacterium's natural ability to introduce genes into plant cells and to use that to literally piggyback in important, commercial genes, like the gene that would create, tolerance to Roundup, or the genes that would enable corn and cotton plants to resist insects. And so a key was really the understanding of the biology of the Agrobacterium and understanding how it naturally introduced genes into plant cells. And
how does it know how to do that?
Well, that's part of the interaction of that bacterium with plants. And in nature, sometimes if you're walking through the woods or you're looking at your rose bushes and you see that big lump, people technically call it a crown gall, that's often caused by Agrobacterium. And the key to our science and the breakthrough was that we took advantage of the bacterium's natural ability to introduce genes, but at the same time we were able to eliminate the disease aspect of it that created the crown gall. So we turned it into the ideal system for introducing genes into plant cells.
Mm-hmm. You said you hearken back to the 1970s when this research began. For you, how has it changed in those 40 years?
It's changed tremendously, both from the science side, obviously, as well as as what's happened in the marketplace. So if you think about, I joined Monsanto in 1981. The first commercial products were developed, 15 years later in 1996, and I give, Monsanto a lot of credit for the risks they took and the investments they made, 15 years in advance in order to lead to the development of the biotech crops. And then you fast forward to today, right now, the latest report in terms of the international advance of biotechnology would indicate that biotech crops are now grown in almost 30 countries. They're planted by literally tens of millions of farmers. And to put it in perspective, the amount of acres or hectares around the world is nearly 20%. And what's really exciting to me personally is the vast majority of the farmers that are using this technology, are now outside the United States. And so, commercially, it's been gigantic. And I think importantly, in many ways, the best is yet to come, because the technology itself is getting to be easier to use. More genes are being studied. And not only are the biotech advances in the form of new biotechnology traits, but the biotechnology methods themselves are being used to improve plant breeding, the use of markers, the ability to understand the changes that our advance through plant breeding has become more and more sophisticated. So, I think in many ways the application of these tools is really just beginning.
Mm-hmm. More specifics on the impact that you were talking about here. I have, according to the statistics, 170 million hectares around the globe, over 17 million farmers. And one thing you didn't mention that is interesting, over 90% of these farmers, small resource, poor farmers in developing countries.
And that is, you know, probably one of the points that doesn't get recognized, and it's one of the things that's so important and unique about a biotechnology seed. Think about it this way. You know, we're taking, you know, the latest technology in gene sequencing and the use of markers, you know, and we're taking that technology and putting it in a seed, a corn seed, a soybean seed, a cotton seed. And the beauty of it is every farmer anywhere in the world, whether it's a large farmer in Iowa or a small cotton farmer in India, knows exactly what to do with the seed. And that means that the traditional barriers to adoption, that a lot of technologies have, don't exist for biotechnology crops. And that's one of the ways and one of the reasons that we've seen such prolific adoption of the technology around the world, is every farmer knows what to do with a better seed.
If you just joined us, my guest this half hour is one of the 2013 World Food Prize laureates, Robert Fraley. Robert Fraley being honored along with Mark Van Montague of Belgium and Mary Dell Chilton, also of the United States, along with Robert, and being honored this year as the 2013 World Food Prize recipients for independently developing the science of modern plant biotechnology. Now, along with the accolades for this year, some of the publicity the World Food Prize gets will likely be, in the form of anger and protests. I'm sure you're aware of this because it's going to you and two other scientists who have played prominent roles in creating genetically engineered crops, so-called Franken-crops by critics, and also because I think you have worked your entire career at Monsanto, and you personify Monsanto's controversial role in American agriculture. In a nutshell, the controversy, I guess if I can sum it up this way, genetically modified foods in dispute over the relative advantages and disadvantages of food derived from genetically modified crops in terms of risk of harm of GM food, whether they should be labeled, whether the role of GM crops generally as part of the industrial agricultural system. What do you have to say to these critics?
And thanks for raising that, because that's exactly, I think, the opportunity that the Food Prize represents. So if I just step back just for a second, I think one of the terrific, you know, implications of where we are today with the technology, you know, I mentioned some of the numbers. You know, in a very short period since 1996, the adoption of this technology around the world has been prolific. You know, we've gone from product launch in the U.S. to now nearly 30 countries. The crops are planted on nearly 20% of the world's farmland. So the adoption has been prolific. You know, I grew up on a small farm in Illinois, and you know, I can remember my dad spending, you know, literally hours or days making seed selections and determining which inputs he was going to use. And you know, as I talk to farmers literally around the world, they're shrewd businessmen. They make their purchase decisions both from an economical perspective, and you know, farmers are the true stewards of the land, because they're the folks who live on the land. So they they make those decisions both with the economics and profitability in mind, as well as the stewardship of the land. And you know, right now you mentioned it, there's 17 million farmers around the world using this technology, and I, for one, you know, for a second, don't believe that a farmer would buy a seed if it didn't have that advantage. So I think the decisions that farmer makes are you know, the clear statement of the benefits of the technology. I think the other really, you know, profound result is, you know, these crops have been, you know, thoroughly tested. In the U.S., it's the USDA, the EPA, and the FDA. But, you know, to sell a biotech corn or soybean seed in the U.S. also means that now, you know, the government regulatory agencies in, you know, nearly 25 countries have also done the same analysis. And the best summary I've seen has actually come out of the European Union, which says, you know, these seeds, the biotech seeds, have been more thoroughly studied and, if anything, are safer than conventional seeds. So I think the fundamental questions of do they have benefit have been answered by 17 million farmers. I think the answer to the question, are they safe, has been demonstrated by over 15 years in the marketplace without a single incident. The food prize really represents the forum to re-engage in that discussion, and that's one of the things I'm really looking forward to. You know, there's loud voices on both sides, the critics who don't like biotechnology and the advocates on the other end. The important discussion occurs in the middle, and that's what I think the food prize affords.
Mm-hmm. Just to be clear, though, because this is really a crux of a point of your critics, is there a broad scientific consensus around the world that food on the market derived from GM crops pose no greater risk than conventional food?
I believe there's a broad scientific consensus, but, you know, as I said earlier, there will be critics on the periphery who will never be satisfied, and that's just going to be the way it is.
Okay, Robert Fraley, my guest, one of the 2013 World Food Prize laureates. Let's talk about a Supreme Court decision back in May, if we could, before we end our conversation. The Supreme Court ruled in May that an Indiana farmer infringed on Monsanto's patent when he planted soybeans that had been genetically modified by Monsanto without buying them from Monsanto. Now, does the Supreme Court case like this affect your work, your research?
Only in the sense that it reaffirms the intellectual property protection, which is, you know, important in terms of the ability to justify the investment. You know, agricultural biotechnology research is really no different than pharmaceutical research or long-term research in any other field. You know, I mentioned earlier that the biotechnology research at Monsanto started in the late 70s. The first products weren't developed for well over 15 years. That type of, you know, long-term investment is very it's very critical to have the ability to protect intellectual property, and I think the Supreme Court's decision reinforces that. But that's a long way from the food prize, and that may be one of the things that we discuss in October. And as I said, I'm really personally looking forward, because I think the food prize platform and the recognition that award has gone to biotechnology really creates a unique forum and a unique opportunity to renew and refresh the discussion. You know, as I kind of close our call here, the thing that drives me, that I'm passionate about, is, you know, if you look over the next 30 or 40 years, we're going to see the 7 billion people on the planet be joined by, you know, another 2 or 3 billion. We're going to have, 9 or 10 billion people. I'm amazed at how world wealth is increased across Asia, across Africa. That means people are going to eat more and better foods. When you wrap all that together, it says that that agriculture over the next 30 or 40 years has to produce twice as much food as it does today. Mm-hmm. And I, for one, believe that the best, and I think really the only way to meet that demand is to use new technologies like biotechnology, like breeding, like some of the new tools that are being developed in point of view of information management, and use those tools effectively to take the lands that we're farming today and increase their yields, because the alternative is going to be, you know, farming more land, which I don't think anybody wants to see, you know, rainforests and wetlands be lost to farming. So I think that's the big middle ground discussion, which is how do we meet that demand for food and how do we use the tools and techniques we have most smartly to achieve that?
Be more specific, too, about where plant biotechnology is headed in the future. What frontiers are left that you see need to be explored and advanced?
Well, to begin with, every day new and more and better genes are being discovered, and so I think it's coincidental that in the same week that I received the news about the World Food Prize, you know, we got approval for a new soybean product for Brazil and a new product in the U.S. for drought guard corn. And so those, you know, drought guard corn is particularly important because it's one of the first of the new biotech products that addresses directly yield and stress. And so it's just an example that the wave of technology coming from biotech continues to expand. I think, you know, also one of the big applications into the future is the application of the biotechnology methods to plant breeding, and that is the use of markers and the ability to really understand every time a plant breeder makes a cross, how those genes in the male and the female recombine to produce new and better seeds. And that information is what's letting us improve dramatically the efficiency of breeding, and that has a tremendous long-term impact for the future. So I am really excited to receive the award, and I'm really proud of what the company has accomplished for the last 15 or 20 years commercially. But what I'm really, really excited about is the opportunity that these new tools have for meeting that doubling in food demand for the future.
Mm-hmm. We have a minute or so left. You mentioned you grew up in Illinois.
That's right. I grew up on a small farm in central Illinois.
I wonder, in closing, if looking back at your childhood, what do you see in terms of your early interests, passions, experiences, perhaps on that farm that pointed to this career in plant biotechnology?
Well, I think when you grow up on a farm and you see that cycle of putting a seed in the ground and the challenges of raising a crop due to weather and diseases, it really imprints on you just how challenging farming can be, and I can remember all that. I always knew I was going to be involved in as a scientist. I had from as early memories, I loved to take things apart, machines. I loved to look at science pictures and anatomy and all those kind of things. So I knew I'd be a scientist at some point, and but I could have never believed that things would have worked out the way they did today.
We appreciate you joining us, and congratulations to you, Rob Fraley.
Thank you. Appreciate it very much, Ben.
2013 World Food Prize laureate Rob Fraley, thank you. Coming up after a short break, the president of the World Food Prize, Ambassador Ken Quinn, will join us live. We'll ask him about the impact and potential of the work of the 2013 World Food Prize laureates and answer any questions you might have about the World Food Prize. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. You can also post something on our Facebook page or tweet us at IPR Talk. Back in just a few minutes, this is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This week, three distinguished scientists were named the winners of the 2013 World Food Prize. Mark Van Montague of Belgium, along with the Americans Mary Dell Chilton and Robert Fraley. The prize is sometimes called the Nobel Prize for Food and Agriculture. And the recipients of this year's World Food Prize were honored for independently developing the science of modern plant biotechnology. Perhaps you caught our first half hour when I had a conversation with new World Food Prize laureate Robert Fraley. And joining me now to continue that discussion, the president of the World Food Prize, Ambassador Ken Quinn, joining us by phone. Ambassador Quinn, welcome to our program.
Well, Ben, thank you. Good to be with you.
Good to be with you. Tell us, first, let me reach out to our listeners because we have you for maybe 5-10 minutes here. We want to reach out to our listeners and have you chip in questions about the World Food Prize or about this year's recipients, 1-866-780-9100, or email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org, post something on our Facebook, or tweet us at IPR Talk. Let me hear from you, Ambassador Quinn. What has been the impact of the work of these three 2013 laureates?
Well, our selection committee, in looking at their work, saw the impact as twofold. One, first of all, they discovered and developed the tools of biotechnology about how you can actually, in the laboratory, transform plants and introduce new traits into them, and which is in one way of taking traditional breeding and expediting it and making it occur very much more quickly and efficiently. So that alone is an incredible scientific achievement and breakthrough for which they should be recognized. But the second part of the World Food Prize is, has there been demonstrated impact? And our committee has been looking at this nomination and this subject for 5 years. It goes back to when Dr. Borlaug was still alive and was still chairing the selection committee and looking at it. And it felt that as we got to 2013, that now the impact had been demonstrated. The use around the world, over 17 million farmers, 170 million hectares around the globe, 90% of these farmers are small, resource-poor farmers in developing countries, more of this work of these crops now being done in developing as opposed to industrial countries, that the time was now that it had been shown conclusively that there was an impact in increasing the quality, the quantity, and availability of food in the world, which is the criteria for our prize.
I think we want to go to the phones here in just a moment, Ambassador Quinn, but before we do that, what do you have to say, broadly speaking, to, of course, genetically engineered crops, a very controversial topic? What do you have to say to the critics who would call them Franken crops and claim harm from the food or to the environment by using such crops?
Well, Dr. Borlaug would say, number one, that science is the most important thing. So we should use science to study the crops, to assess them, to see what the impact is, to see if there are harmful features associated with them in that regard. And there have not apparently been demonstrated that there are on that. And secondly is, and the most important thing in my view, is that the big game changer now is the climate volatility that we are experiencing. And the challenges and the scenarios that have been painted by Dr. Jim Yong Kim, the new president of the World Bank, of what these variations in climate and temperature and weather can mean in the next 20 to 30 years in terms of rising seas, of drought, of saltwater intrusion on agricultural production are enormous. And to me, and I believe Dr. Borlaug would have said if he could be here, that we have to use everything in our hands to deal with this, to ensure that the poorest farmers, who are the ones who are always most impacted, will have every opportunity to be able to continue to produce food, feed themselves, feed their countries in face of these enormous climate volatility that we face.
Ambassador Ken Quinn is with us, president of the World Food Prize, 1-866-780-9100. A little bit of time for some feedback, perhaps some questions from our audience. Listener Jeffrey is listening in Fairfield. Hi, Jeffrey. Go ahead. Jeffrey, are you there?
Hello, this is Jeffrey Smith.
Jeffrey Smith, go ahead, please.
Yes. Yes, Ambassador, I heard what you said about genetically modified foods, and it's not actually fully correct. The science that's been done evaluating the risks of GMOs by industry, which is the primary science that's used to evaluate these, has been essentially caught, they've been caught red-handed as tobacco science, rigging their research to avoid finding problems. But when independent researchers do studies, they find damage to virtually every organ and every system studied in the animals. In fact, there was so much evidence of problems, the American Academy of Environmental Medicine urged all doctors to prescribe non-GMO diets to every patient, and now thousands of doctors are doing just that. Our Institute for Responsible Technology has been collecting the case studies from these doctors and from individuals, and we find a remarkable volume of pretty significant and dramatic recoveries from diseases and disorders when people switch to non-GMO foods.
Jeffrey, we're going to get it, make sure we have time for a response, so let's go to Ambassador Quinn.
Yeah, hi. Well, Dr. Smith, so nice to talk to you. I've heard a lot about you. I'm glad to be able to have this initial dialogue with you. And I very much hope that you'll come in October and be here and be part of this. I'm a political scientist, not an agricultural scientist. But what I do is turn to the experts that I can find at our land-grant universities and other research institutes and look to them for their input and for their reaction and their analysis. And, of course, I don't choose the winner of our prize. Our selection committee does, and headed by a very eminent and respected scientist, Dr. M.S. Swaminathan. And in looking at that, and he issued a statement about this, about what the prospects and the impact are of these. But it's very, very important to have the dialogue that you spoke of and to bring all of these issues, because we need to know, is biotechnology, are these enhanced or modified crops and foods, are they appropriate to trying to deal with the challenges, the enormous challenges from climate volatility, or is it, should we just exclude them and use whatever else we can?
Okay. Jeffrey, it sounds like a conversation for an entire show. Perhaps as we close in on the fall, that would be a good conversation to have.
That would be great.
Thank you for calling, Jeffrey from Fairfield.
Pleasure.
And let's go to another caller. Let's go to Des Moines. Jessica is with us. Hi, Jessica. Just a few more minutes with Ambassador Quinn. What do you have for us?
Yeah, I have some questions just because the World Food Prize was given to three people, like the creators of GMOs. And the dominant narrative right now is that we need to feed the world. But most of these crops are actually going to energy and fuel. We're not actually feeding the world. And the real, like, you know, real food prize should be going to somebody who is creating sustainable agriculture on a local level, so that way local communities can support their own food systems. I'm just curious, at what point did the World Food Prize become the corporate ag food prize?
Jessica, thank you for that question from Des Moines. Ambassador.
Well, we pride ourselves on reaching across many disciplines. We'd be very anxious to have nominations in the areas that were just mentioned. We've had NGO leaders, presidents of countries, scientists who do conventional breeding, soil scientists. So we're very anxious to have all of them nominated, have all of them considered, and we endeavor to be the organization that reaches across the totality of the food chain, from the smallholder farmers through growers, processors, those who market food. Every aspect of it is certainly open to be considered for our prize.
Jessica, thank you for that question from Des Moines. Our last question, please, a brief question. Dan from Scott County, you'll be a final question for Ambassador Quinn.
Yes. Good afternoon, Ambassador Quinn. I agree with Jeffrey Smith. I can't believe he would give the food prize to Monsanto scientist Robert Fraley in regards to the science that's out there. It's been out there for years. And my question to Mr. Quinn is, why would Monsanto be fighting to place the initiative on the ballot to label GMO food? What are they hiding? We want to know why, if it's all good and they say it's good, why are they fighting any initiative like Prop 13 in California and many other states that want, consumers want to know what they're eating in their food? And I just don't understand it. As a farmer and as an organic farmer, this is really a travesty, what you've done.
Dan, thank you for your reaction from Scott County. Ambassador Quinn.
Sure. Well, I want to point out that our prize is always given to individuals. Not given to organizations, to companies, to institutions. It's to individual scientists or leaders or experts or farmers, whoever, for what they have done and what the impact has had. So there are questions about an institution or organization and what its policies are. They really ought to be directed to them. These are three people who developed the tools of biotechnology. It's a remarkable scientific achievement, and the crops that they've produced are being utilized by a great, great many people around the world, and to their benefit.
The president of the World Food Prize, Ambassador Ken Quinn, we thank you for joining us for a few minutes. We appreciate it, sir.
Sure. Glad to be on. Glad to take questions.
Okay. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And finally today, capitalism. Does it work for you? That's a question on a 20-foot-long sign with flashing lights that's come to Cedar Rapids. Viewers vote by pressing true or false. Perhaps you, as someone listening, have been by the sign and pressed true or false. Does capitalism work for you? The project, a full exhibit featuring that sign and video responses to it, is opening today at CSPS Hall. That's on 3rd Street in Cedar Rapids, to run through August 11th. My next guest for the next few minutes, the artist behind the project, Steve Lambert, in the studio with me. Hi, Steve. Welcome.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for having me.
You've been around the country with this 20-foot-long sign, capitalism. Does it work for you? I want to ask you, how did you come up with the idea and why?
Well, I found that I made a lot of work about power and systems and things like that. And I found that, you know, in public, when we talk about the economy, we use all these euphemisms like the market. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the different crises that were happening, you know, whether you call it the financial crisis or the mortgage crisis or some kind of business crisis. But there's all these ways we talk around this. And I wanted to find a way to talk about it directly, but also make it personal, not make it a kind of global idea. Does capitalism work for the world or work for the country? But does it work for you? Is it working for you in your life? And allow people to sort of give them a situation where they have to think about it and make a decision.
Mm-hmm. So while it may seem simplistic, say forcing someone to choose between true and false, you're looking for something larger than that?
Yeah, so I've called it deceptively simple, right? So it's a statement, capitalism works for me, and you decide whether that's true or false. But the more you think about it, usually with most people, the more things start to unravel and it gets more and more complicated.
Okay. We want to reach out to our listeners. Only a few minutes with Steve Lambert, but perhaps you would like to answer that question. Does capitalism work for you, true or false? Briefly tell us why. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org, or email, tweet us at IPR Talk, or find us on Facebook, post something on our Facebook page. Can you tell us, you've been in Cedar Rapids since when this week?
I got here on Saturday.
Okay, you got here on Saturday, a few days to collect truths and falses. Does mm-hmm. capitalism work for people of Cedar Rapids, people coming by that sculpture? What is the tally so far?
Well, we were set up in front of the Nubo Market on Sunday and had a lot of people come by. And we actually had more true votes, like by ratio, than we do in most cities. Usually it's pretty even. There it was 155 true, 77 false. So it was about 2-1 in the end of people saying that capitalism worked for them.
And you're saying that Cedar Rapidians or
apparently this is a place to live. You know, like I'm thinking about moving here because it's just
capitalism works.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay,
but you know, I wanted to come to Cedar Rapids partly because of, you know, like corn subsidies. I found out that there's been like $16 billion in corn subsidies that have come here between 1995 and 2012. And then the flood recovery money, you know, but apparently for a lot of the folks that we encountered, it seems to be working. But there's different kinds of answers. Sometimes people vote true, but they have reasons, you know. So one woman that voted true, she was a special ed instructor. And she said for her, it worked. You know, she was able to get by. She was able to save money. She had a good job. But she realized that for her students, it wasn't working. Some were coming hungry, and she fed students in her classroom in order for them, you know, they needed to sort of be, if they were hungry, they couldn't learn as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, and she also mentioned that in the past, she had been on food stamps and received assistance. So it hadn't always worked for her, but it's working now. So she voted true, but it's a complex answer.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if, in your discussions, there were any alternatives mentioned, because you have, does capitalism work for you versus what? Nothing. Or, of course, we know the chief modern global rival to capitalism collapsed at the end of the 20th century, communism. Did that come up in conversations?
Of course it did. It comes up all the time, and it came up more than ever in Cedar Rapids. For some reason, this is still the looming ghost of communism is still haunting the state.
A hotbed of capitalism and communism?
Yeah, well,
right
at least the ghost still haunts here. But yeah, for some reason, this is part of the reason I made the sign, is people think of, well, what's the alternative? It's these two things, socialism and communism, that we have seen as failed, right? So the only thing we have left is the system that everyone would kind of admit is a little bit flawed, like could be better, right?
Mm-hmm.
But what are we going to do? And so when people say, what are you proposing as alternative? I say something better. And then that usually slows them down. And the idea is that this is America, right? Like the capitalism isn't in our constitution. We get to decide the economic system, and it's a democracy, and we can make changes if we want to. But in order to make changes, we have to be able to think of it as a little bit flexible or something that can be at least evaluated, right? If we can't evaluate it, whether or not it's working for us or not, how are we supposed to imagine a way that it could be better?
Among those who said that capitalism was not working for them, what were the chief complaints, the gripes against capitalism?
There was one guy that came by the market who was a cook, and he worked with homeless people. And he said, you know, for him, it's very clear that it was not working for most of the people in his life. There was another guy who was a veteran coming back from Iraq and said the opportunities for veterans coming back from Iraq just were not what they should be. And so for him, capitalism wasn't working.
Mm-hmm. Now, you set out when, not just to come to Cedar Rapids, but when did this sculpture first appear? When did it make its premiere? In what city?
We started about 2 years ago in Cleveland. And it went from Cleveland, it would stay there for a few months, then to Boston, then Connecticut, Santa Fe, San Diego, Los Angeles, here. After here, it goes to Times Square.
You are booked out for a while.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you, before that first Cleveland exhibit, did you have any inkling it would catch on as it has?
I hoped. You know, like, it was an ambitious project. The thing is physically massive, and moving around the country takes a lot of coordination. In every city, there's teams of people that help out with it. And so receiving that kind of support has been really great. There's clearly a lot of people that want to tackle this question, or at least begin to unravel it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I don't, like, after Times Square, it goes to a museum, this museum called the Tang Museum in upstate New York. I don't know where it will go after that. Oh, there's also another one in Europe. I didn't know that was going to happen. So
another sign like yours?
Yeah, yeah. So in Europe, they wanted to show it, but we didn't have two of them, so they built one. So it's shown in Holland, and right now another one is showing in Liverpool.
Oh, that's interesting.
I expected.
Did you get a chance to compare European responses with the North American responses yet?
Yeah.
That's a future thing.
Yeah.
You mentioned that Cedar Rapids was relatively in favor of capitalism compared to, by what, 2-1, you said?
Yeah, at least at the Nouveau Market on Sunday. Since it's been in the gallery, capitalism is taking a beating. The people that work in arts and culture here, I guess it's not as lucrative.
Now, I imagine when people, there are two big buttons, right? True,
yeah.
False, and you press those. I imagine not only the answer and the responses you get, the stories you get, but watching the behavior of the people pushing the buttons, is that sometimes interesting?
Oh, yeah. I mean, when you come across this giant metal sign all of a sudden that appears someplace, there's this stunned, you know, and the lights are flashing. It's kind of mesmerizing. But that's part of the purpose, is like to catch people off guard. And then they have to think about, like, well, what is this? Why is it here? Make sense of it. And then there's the question. So, you know, I've found working with art is like if something's in a museum and it looks like a painting, you know, it's really easy to dismiss because you're like, oh, that's a painting and I don't really get that. But if it's just like a giant sign that shows up in the middle of a park
asking for your input.
Yeah. It's like, well, what is this? And you have to think about it a whole lot more. And that's the purpose of the piece, is to sort of get people to some cognition happening around an issue that we usually just sort of gloss over.
That we take as a given.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, I want to remind people that a full exhibit featuring this sign, it's a 20-foot-long sign with flashing lights that's come to Cedar Rapids. Viewers vote by pressing true or false. It's going to be a full exhibit featuring the sign, along with video responses, today, opening today at CSPS in the Cedar Rapids. That's on 3rd Street in Cedar Rapids. Did you have
anything? Yeah, I'll be there, too, from 5 to 7.
5 to 7 o'clock tonight. The exhibit will run through August 11th. Are you allowed to vote still on it, or is it kind of voting closed?
No, yeah, still there. It's set up, and it's keeping score. Yeah.
Okay. Steve Lambert, the artist behind the project, good luck with that.
Thank you.
Very, very interesting, very simple, deceptively simple.
Yes.
Is that what you said? Thank you, Steve Lambert, coming into our studio. River to River is produced by Sarah Bowden, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. In Des Moines, help from John Pemble. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.